So John chapter 17, what's going on here? At what point in the life of Christ are we at by the time you get to this part of the Gospel of John? We're inching our way toward this section of the Gospel of John right now in the sermons I'm preaching on Sunday morning. But what's going on here by the time of John 17? Is this? Oh yeah, go ahead, Emily. That's exactly right. They have sort of left the upper room and they're walking along the way to get to the Garden of Gethsemane. And in chapters 13 through 17, Jesus is giving private instructions to the disciples, culminating here with this prayer in John 17, sometimes called Jesus' high priestly prayer. Your Bible may even have a heading that says the high priestly prayer of Jesus. And in the course of this prayer, the simple phrase I wanted to point out to you is in verse 16, John chapter 17 and verse 16, where Jesus says of his followers, "They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world." So this is the quality of Jesus that we're going to talk about tonight. It's hard to frame this in positive terms. Negatively, we are not of the world. Not of the world. If we were going to phrase it in a positive term, maybe we would say otherworldly, but then that sounds like ghostly, you know, like apparitions, you know. So we'll just say not of the world is the idea here. All right, now the first thing we've got to do to understand what's involved in this here is to understand what is meant by the word world. So to illustrate a couple of different things that can mean, let's go all the way back to John chapter 1. Okay, so turn back to John chapter 1. And I'd like to just read verse 10. John chapter 1 and verse 10. And let me call on John. Haley, would you read that for us, please?
Sure. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him.
All right. So he was in the world was made through him, the world did not know him. Same word here, world. But there's a lot of different things going on here with these uses of the word world. So, first of all, when it says he was in the world and the world was made through him, when John uses that term, what's he talking about? Yeah, we might say the earth, the cosmos, the world that we live in. Or we might say the created world, the world in creation, that which the Lord made. And in fact, we would even say that based on Genesis 1, that world is good. That sense of the word world is good because it's the good world that God has made. And yet, there's not anything good about the next phrase, is it? Because how does verse 10 end? The world did not know him. Now, there when John is using the word world, what do you think he's talking about? All right, so you would be talking about its inhabitants. But maybe we could take it a step further, because is there a, unlike the first use, which even sort of has biblically a positive nuance, the good world God has made, what's the obvious flavor of this use of the word world? Yeah, the sinfulness of the world. So, you know, we could probably come up with all kinds of ways to distinguish these uses, but there's the created world, and then you might say the rebellious world. The created world and the sinful world. You know, there's a million ways we could kind of distinguish these two. But it's a cool passage because you can see the two uses here, the two different ways that this could be used. All right, so now then, let's flip back to that verse we started with, right? So go back to John chapter 17, and then let's try to determine what Jesus has in mind here in verse 16. So when he says in John chapter 17 and verse 16, they are not of the world just as I am not of the world, which of those concepts, which of those nuances of the word world does Christ have in mind? So does he mean that his followers are not a part of the created world? Well, yeah, obviously not. We are certainly part of the created world. So obviously, when he says they're not of the world, what does he have in mind there? Yeah, the world in rebellion, the world in sin. The same usage of that word that you see back in chapter 1 when it says that he came into the world was made through him. Those are thumbs up worlds, but then the world did not know him. That's thumbs down. Right? That's maybe our new theological definition. Thumbs up and thumbs down worlds. All right. So yeah, that gives you a good idea of what to think about here. Now, another place that we can go to really get some good insight into what the Lord has in mind and what John has in mind as he presents this word to us is there's a very famous passage in John's first epistle when he talks about the world and our response to it that I think will give us a lot of insight. Okay, so hold your place here and let's go over to 1 John, the second chapter. 1 John chapter 2. First John chapter 2, and I want you to look at verses 15, 16, and 17. He says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Now, if we didn't know what he was going to say next, that seems like a very broad way of speaking. And it seems even almost odd because the Bible talks about the created order as a gift of God, something to be enjoyed and be grateful for. But remember, there are these two different ways that the Bible can speak of the world. The created world, but then there is also the rebellious world, the sinful world. And that's obviously then what he would have in mind here, which he then spells out here. Verse 16, "For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and the pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world." And that gives us then a really good definition. I was curious, by the way, and I did not think to check this. The ESV says is not from the Father, but is from the world. Did any of your translations say is not of the Father, but is of the world? Which one are you using, Jason? New King James. And of course, that word "of" can certainly carry that that connotation. But you can see here what he's talking about. There are, you might say, there are two spheres. There is the divine sphere and there is the sinful sphere. And there are those values and virtues and blessings that come from God. And then there are those things that emanate from the world in its rebellious and sinful sense. And so what John tells us here is, if you want to know what the world in the rebellious, sinful sense is all about, here's what it's all about. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life, depending on how your translation renders this. In other words, everything bad, all the bad avenues in life, that's the world in its sinful sort. And so then this gives you kind of an idea of when Jesus back in John 17 says, "They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world," what he's talking about here. Jesus was certainly of the world in the sense that he was born as a human being, and he lived on the planet, and he did earthly things like sweat, bleed, and cry, and eat, and sleep, and drink. But his, from a moral standpoint, what he did was not of the world in the sense of the rebellious, sinful world. The world dominated by the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eye and the pride of life. In fact, that's exactly the opposite of what Jesus was like. Jesus was somebody who lived in this good created world, but who lived under the control of this Father's sphere, the sphere of God, and not the sphere of the world. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? Pretty, you know, standard kind of stuff here then. And, of course, the problem is, for us, that while it's easy sort of theoretically to separate the worlds in that sense, right? The good created world and then the sinful rebellious world. The fact of the matter is those worlds collide in day-to-day life, don't they? Because we live in this world that God has given us, and yet it's also in this very same sphere that God has given to us that those other things can arise. So think about it. Think about the Garden of Eden. Was it good? Yeah. Was it given by God? Yeah. But was there also the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life that could exist there? Well, yeah, that's almost how Genesis even describes Eve's reaction to the tree, right? It was, she saw that it was good for food and a delight to the eyes and was desired to make one wise, you know? So, yeah, you've got this good world, but also that good world can potentially be a place where what is good becomes perverted, twisted, distorted, subverted, substituted, and caves in on itself, like what happens in the case of lust and sin. So that's why this can be a challenge sometimes to live here, because we're kind of in a war of the worlds here, right? But anyway, any basic questions over some of this general terminology? Now, if you think about it, this even all the more makes more beautiful probably the most famous passage in the Bible. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son that whoever believes in him might not perish. So the world that he loves is the world that would perish had he not loved it. See that? So it is the world even in this sinful and rebellious sense. So not only does God love his good creation, but also God even loves his rebellious creation. He desires it not to stay that way. He desires it to repent and be restored and to come back to him, which is an amazing and wonderful thing, right? So that's what's described for us then here in that most beautiful of all verses. All right, so that's the basic premise then that the New Testament gives to us, that just like Christ, we are not to be of the world. That doesn't mean that we escape the world. The idea here is not, as you know, some religious groups and orders have done, where you just sort of like create a commune, and that's not the point at all. But rather, we live in this world, but we are not to be directed by, guided by, dominated by the impulses of those sinful avenues. So any questions or comments? Yeah, Ralph? Yeah.
Being that that is really a sinful world that we talk about, is the things that Satan puts before us, that tempts us.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought it was interesting that the aspect of the sinful nature of this world is a sinful temptation that Satan uses.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, Ralph. And in fact, if you do a concordant search for the word world, you're going to see a lot of them ping up here in the Gospel of John. And we've already seen him, if you've got a really good memory and can go back to those earliest sermons that I've done this year, back in the spring, from John 1, he's already used this word several times there to kind of prepare the stage for the usage that really bubbles up, especially sort of like starting with the entry of Jesus in Jerusalem. For example, remember what the Lord says in John chapter 12. The hour has come, and now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Save me from this hour. And the Father says, I have glorified you, and I will glorify your name again. And then Jesus says in John 12:31, now is the judgment of the world. Now the prince, the ruler of the world will be cast out. And so there's the usage then of Jesus in his death on the cross is actually pronouncing judgment upon sinfulness, you know, upon the world of sinfulness. And he is going to deliver a decisive blow to defeat the one who is the ruler of this world. Again, not in the sense of the devil being the ruler of the created order, that's God, but the one who is the instigator and the prime leader of the world in its sinful, rebellious state. Yeah. So yeah, you can really tie that together, there as well. Well. All right, let me just extend this point here just a little bit further. Look over in John chapter 18 just for a minute. Just to really clarify these differences in the word world, I'm going to try to trick you up tonight, okay, with a very diabolical question, all right? The trick question. Like some of you probably just got on your final exams, right? Like this is a Thaxter Dickey level trick question here, all right? So John chapter 18, and I'd like for somebody to read for us verse 36. Nick, could you read verse 36 for us? All right. Now, very interesting, by the way. What translation is that? New King James. The New King James, how it ends that. So when Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. All right. Trick question alert. Trick question alert. Is Jesus the king of this world? Yes. Yeah. When you confess Jesus is Lord, that's exactly what. If he's not the king over this world, who is he king over? Right? Now, does everybody on this globe acknowledge him as such? Well, that's a whole separate question there, right? But yeah, so what does he mean when he says, my kingdom is not of this world? Well, one of the big clues is, it's curious to me how the New King James translated the last part of that phrase. What did it say again? My kingdom is not from here. That means his kingdom authority. Where did he get it from? Yeah, he got it from God, God's sphere. It didn't come from the human sphere. And because if it did, how would he have gotten it? And that's what this verse says, right? My kingdom is not of this world, otherwise what? Yeah, how do you derive kingdom authority from this world in its, you know, corrupt, sinful sense? Yeah. Conquest, war, violence. That's what a worldly kingdom is like in that sense. So very good. I thought I would, you know, like really just trick everybody out here, but you're just so wise and sophisticated. That's exactly right. Jesus' kingdom is of this world in the sense that Jesus is king over this world. In fact, that's what the whole Great Commission is about. We're supposed to go tell people that. All authority is given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples. So that's what we're telling everybody. Jesus is king and you need to follow him. But it is not from this world in the sense that he doesn't derive his authority from the sinful, rebellious world. He got that authority. He got that authority from God. All right, so then Ralph kind of already hinted at this then. This is what our challenge is if we are to be like Christ, is we have to live in this world in the sense of this created world. But we also are living in a created world in which many things have gone against what God intended. So we live in a good world that has sinful people and can really make it tough to live like you should in this world. And that's the challenge that we sometimes boil down to the phrase that more or less comes right out of what Ralph mentioned there in John chapter 17, which is that we are to be in the world but not of the world. We are in this created world given by God, but we are not to be under the influence of sin, the sinful, rebellious world. All right? Now, would anybody like to share some ways that you find this very difficult on a practical level? How do you find it difficult to pull this idea off? We are in this world, on this planet, but we are not to be of the world under the sway of sinful, rebellious humanity. What are some issues you've encountered? Yeah, John?
The issues are that the only thing that I can relate to through the senses are invisible realms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to envision what comes after this.
Mm-hmm.
It's sometimes difficult to keep working towards something that everything else in the world you can, you know, see the achievement of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just in terms of, you know, the passage in 2 Corinthians 5:7, we walk by faith, not by sight, but it is a lot easier to walk by sight, right? Generally speaking, yeah. Yeah, hand up over here.
C.S. Lewis talks in Screwtape Letters, his demonic protagonist is advising his nephew. One of the things that always struck me about that is he talks about, in the context of World War II, he said, if you can persuade a Christian that his cause, whatever his cause may be, whether it's political or national or warfare, whatever it may be, if you can persuade him to so dedicate himself to the cause that his Christianity becomes just another tool in service to that cause, you've won a soul to the darkness. And I think that's one of the great temptations we face, particularly in today where there's so many causes, there's so many mm-hmm. things that are brought to our attention. A lot of the worldly things that are going on almost demand you to treat your Christianity as a subsection of your devotion to a political party, your devotion to a particular cause in life. And I think that's one of the great temptations we face is our Christianity can become secularized and become part of our worldly causes.
Right, yeah. So what Andrew was basically saying is that, you know, if you think about the Christian life as a piece of pie, and you've got 8 different pieces, and one piece is your job, and one piece is your family, and one piece is being a citizen, and then one piece is being a Christian. Then, when you have that concept, then it's easy to segregate and compartmentalize the Christian part, and then let all the other things kind of take over, like a cause of some kind or the other, you know, particularly a political cause or a militaristic cause or a social justice cause or what have you. But as we emphasized, especially the first month of this class, that the idea of following Jesus is by its very nature non-compartmentalized. You know, when Jesus calls people to follow him, he's not saying, follow me, you know, Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays from 2 to 4. You're making an entire life commitment to give your life to him. And that is supposed to keep us from doing this. But yeah, no, that's definitely something that can happen. Yeah, Cindy?
From a practical standpoint, I think about like being an adult and just like physical. As an adult, like when we're working out, there are certain things that you know cross the line, you're not going to go do this and this and that and other, but you find yourself in those situations where even if they know what you believe and stuff like that, well, you can go and you still have to partake. But then are you condoning? And then you get into that gray area and this and that and the other. So that's what I think of, you know.
Right. So Cindy brought up what I actually thought would be the very first thing that would come up tonight, which is work. Because on the one hand, work, from a Bible standpoint, is a very good thing. I know sometimes some of us were taught work was the curse of sin, which is not true at all. The toil of labor by sweat of your brow is the curse of sin. But God gave Adam the task to cultivate and keep the garden before there was sin. So work is a very good and noble and holy thing. And to live and to thrive in this world, this good created world, you learn from the ant, like I talked about Sunday night. And you gather and you save and everything else. So that's a very good thing. But then so many times the world in its sinful, rebellious, subversive sense crashes into the good sense when it comes to work. Either because you've got a boss that wants you to cut some corner somewhere and be dishonest in order to have better, a better profit margin or to get a product out in time, or just because you have to work with other people, and a lot of them are not living in the sphere of God. They're living in the very sphere of the world. I know when my mom, who was unfaithful for years, when she came back to the Lord, her friends at work, it was tough for a while because this was not the same friend they knew, and she didn't want to go do the same things they did. And so, yeah, the workplace presents all sorts of areas where these the war of the worlds kind of, you know, crashes into each other and collides. I used to always be amazed because, you know, my work world is pretty nice. I got to admit, I work with pretty good people for the most part. A few exceptions here and there, but I mean, for the most part, it's a good place. But the horror stories Christy would tell me about, well, I remember one time she accidentally dialed and called me while she was interrogating one of her employees for shoplifting from the store. But one of the employees, stealing out of the cash registers, like I was watching Cops, you know, on television to hear that. So that's just it's a hard thing for me to wrap my mind around. But y'all are sitting there thinking, you should see what happens where I work, you know. So yeah, work is one of those areas where these worlds can definitely collide. Yeah, Nick and then Leanne.
Mm-hmm. The internet, and it's Facebook, it's Instagram, it's whatever those kids are getting inundated with, and it's all the flesh, and Satan's getting in there early. And I think that has a huge impact on our ability to cleanse ourselves of that, allow ourselves to be cleansed of it, because it gets roots in there.
Yeah, no, Nick's raising a good point, and actually I want to expand on it and clarify something too. So Nick was just talking about the fact that, you know, we live in a world of, now I'm curious, when you said a world of the flesh, did you mean flesh in sort of a neutral way of like a physical world, or flesh in the sinful way of like the works of the flesh? Yeah, no, you're exactly right, and you know, there are things, especially that our kids are having to deal with now, and through social media. Through if their parents, so there are no high school and junior high kids here. Now, I'm just going to tell you, I'm not a parent, so I'm going to give you advice on how to raise your kids, all right, which comes from my 0 years of experience. But I will tell you as your preacher what I think. If you give your kids unmonitored access to cell phones and smartphones and computers, that's crazy. I just got to tell you, it's crazy. And I hate to say it if you do that, but I'm the one that sometimes has to come along and try to help when things blow up because you've done that, so I might as well just tell you what I feel now. It's like I told a guy one time, I had an enlightening moment when I was a single guy and one of the married guys showed up at my house at midnight banging on the door crying because his wife left him. And so I decided at that point, if I have to listen to you at midnight talk about your marriage, you have to listen to me on Sundays talk about marriage, all right? That's kind of the rule here, all right? So I kind of feel that now about kids too, but I mean, just given what, you know, what's out there, it's just a world in which the access to that kind of stuff is far too easy for people who do not have the moral discrimination to understand how to navigate it. They don't have the maturity and moral discernment to figure their way out unless you give them that kind of guidance and counsel. So yeah, and those can be good things. They can be tools to use as a from God's good created order to serve Him. I mean, there's a lot of good and wonderful things that can be done through technology and even through social media. But so here's one of the things that you can kind of think about. If you think about that language in 1 John chapter 2, from the Father. A big part of this is, do we view the things in our experience as gifts from God to use for Him? And if you're always in that mindset, then it helps you navigate a lot of these specific questions. Yeah, Leanne?
I was just going to say about work,
And really, for a lot of us, it's our only opportunity.
Sure.
If we spend all our time amongst Christians, we're
right.
just one giant light.
Right.
When we go into these places, you know, not surrounded, where we're not surrounded by Christians, our light should shine pretty bright. And it's easy to stand out in that. And if we look at that as an opportunity and not something that's scary or, you know, it can be difficult to navigate.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think what especially helps in that is when you're trying to live a life that's not segmented and compartmentalized off, if you just have a conscious awareness that every day I'm supposed to be like Christ, then that governs what you're like at work and governs like what you're like at school and what you're like at home and what you're like as a neighbor and so forth, rather than saying, oh, I got to go to work now, but then I'll go to church, you know. So it's definitely that shift. Yeah, Dave?
Heather Cloud, Texas. She went to Texas A&M. She had a roommate who was a member of the church. She found out I was a member of the church once we went to lunch together. And she said, you people never have any fun. That was her idea of what a member of the church.
Right, yeah. Like if... Right, there's an old adage that a Puritan is somebody who is concerned that someone somewhere at some time is having some fun, right? So I'll tell you what, these progressive social justice warriors have far exceeded the Puritans in that regard, I think. They seem to be eager to stamp out happiness. Sorry for that political commentary there here. But anyway, it's the same mentality gone to seed. Yeah, Larry?
Mm-hmm. That would have been the cosmos or intellectual world. So if the intellectual world was destroyed, what world was Noah's family a part of?
Sure. So now I don't think I understand exactly what you mean by the like the intellectual world. So I think sometimes cosmos or world can have the idea of, so there's the created world, and then sometimes there's the people of the world. And then sort of the world in its livable state. So like obviously if you think about the flood did not make the planet like blow up. So it wasn't that kind of destruction of the world. But it was a destruction of life that was on the world, if that makes any sense. Yeah. And it was caused by the sinfulness of the people in the world. So that world in its sinful, rebellious sense. So that's one of those things you can... think about where sort of like those two meanings converge, right? So like think about it like this. If this is a bad illustration, but it'll get the point across. If my home state of Kentucky decides that the people of West Virginia have just ticked us off one last time, Lori, and we drop a bomb on them, all right, what world did we destroy? Well, we're destroying what we think is the sinful world, but is the actual physical material world also going to have repercussions? Yeah. Yeah, so that would be like, you know, both. It would be both the physical world and then also the sinful people in the world. So sometimes that kind of happens both ways. Yeah. Nick, I think you had your hand up.
I got to come back to the pie. I also mentioned
my invitation. Sure. Yeah, that's right.
Christ.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's great, Nick. Yeah, make the filling Christ. See, you're speaking my language right now, Nick. This pie filling illustration is going to carry a lot of traction. Back in the old days of overhead transparencies, I'll talk to you guys about what those are. All right, go to the Museum of Science and Industry. They'll have some on display there. But that's one of the things that I would have is I would have this. I hand drew, it looked so horrible, picture of this dude, and then I would have his family life here and his work life here and all that kind of stuff. But then I overlaid Christ, you know, in his heart with a transparency, and then drew arrows and then wrote down the verses to talk about how you love your wife as Christ loved the church, and how you are obedient to the government as unto the Lord, and all those kind of things. Well, yeah, that's exactly right. Where the filling is Christ. In fact, if you think about it, our theme verse for this year puts it like that, because it says, Christ in you, the hope of glory. It's Christ in you. And one of the verses that we looked at earlier this quarter, in Galatians 4:19, where Paul says, you know, I'm in agony like a woman in childbirth until Christ, he says, is formed in you. And that's one of the verses that we talked about as the concept of what Christ-likeness is. It is when Christ is in us to the point that all the different areas of life we're looking at are under his control. And so what we've been talking about tonight is the idea of world, being in the world but not of the world as Christ. And, you know, if you think about it, just if you reflect on the life of Christ, he truly is like the perfect model of how to live in a world in which you hunger and thirst and work and sleep and travel and you meet people and you have conflicts, but yet always be under the control of the Father and living according to the sphere of the Father's influence and not the lustful enticements of the world and its rebellious and sinful sense. Yeah, that's exactly right. Let's take a look here at another passage. Look over in John 15. John chapter 15. Really appreciate your all's comments and things that you've shared about this. I would imagine if we had some of our high school kids in here and we could get them to talk, which would be another thing altogether, then they could talk to us about what it's like to be in the world but not of the world as a high school student. Let's just read these verses here. John 15, 18, and 19. If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. And so Jesus just emphasizing here that there's a very strong sense in which, as we imitate him, we have to be separate from the world. In this world, this good world God has made, but realizing that there are evil things about it that we have to be on guard against. All right, well, thanks so much for all of your comments. And if you have any left over, be sure to remember them, and we'll pick them up and go over them on Sunday.